It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a nurse treating an Ebola patient in Dallas has contracted the virus. We'll talk to the head of Wisconsin Nurses Group about what's being done to prepare healthcare workers for Ebola.
First, antibiotics were the wonder drugs of the 20th century. They allowed doctors to cure once fatal infections such as tuberculosis and meningitis.
By mid-century, the drugs had another purpose, preventing disease and promoting growth in farm livestock as demand for meat in the United States grew rapidly.
The practice became widespread, and by the late 1970s, FDA Commissioner Donald Kennedy sought to cut back on the use of antibiotics on farms as research suggested that overuse may lead to bacteria mutations and then antibiotic resistance in humans.
His efforts were fought by meat producers, and no restrictions were placed on antibiotic use on farms. Today, the Union of Concerned Scientists estimates that up to 84% of antimicrobial use in the United States goes to preventing disease and promoting growth in livestock.
For supporters of antibiotic regulations, the challenge is to prove a direct link between antibiotic use in animals and drug-resistant bacteria in humans. There's no conclusive research yet, but a new Frontline documentary airing today shows that scientists are starting to put the pieces together.
That documentary is called The Trouble with Antibiotics. It airs tonight at 9 on your public television station. The producer of the documentary, David Hoffman, joins us now. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So before now, during the 20th century leading up to about a decade ago, what kind of research was out there about the connection between this antibiotic use on livestock and drug-resistant strains in humans?
You know, it wasn't conclusive. And you mentioned Dr. Kennedy's efforts in 1977. And even he said then, you know, it's a theoretical possibility. He wasn't sure, but what he was worried about was that if we overused some antibiotics on livestock and poultry and so on, that they could create resistance not only to that particular antibiotic, but to others. And he was worried about that because bacteria swap information about resistance between each other. And so it's quite possible that this process, this genetic mechanism of learning how to resist antibiotics, could spread. Now, Dr. Kennedy said that in a public statement in 1977, but he never had any luck getting restrictions imposed. They were blocked by the Congress.
Now, one of the people you interview in this documentary says, in effect, the effort to find a smoking gun is really hard, to say these antibiotics on this farm applied to this livestock led to this disease or antibiotic-resistant bacteria in a human. How big a challenge is that?
Well, the person who said that was Dr. Kennedy in the show, but he said in 1977 he didn't have a smoking gun. But since then, we've learned a lot about genetics, and the show takes a look at three teams of researchers who are attempting to draw the line. It's very difficult to connect those dots, but on the other hand, I think the show suggests that this is a point in time when we know resistance to antibiotics for human health is a real problem. That's incontrovertible. Antibiotic resistance is growing. The president's advisors on science and technology issued a report just the other day saying we're now at dire risk of losing the progress with antibiotics. So if we have a public health problem for all of us, for the whole society, if everybody is threatened by this particular problem, we ought to be asking again and with renewed vigor, what's causing it? Well, we know that people cause part of it. We overused antibiotics for many, many years. That caused part of it. But I think this idea that agriculture has a role to play needs to be examined. We can't just be in denial and say, no, they're not at fault. They're not the culprit. Carry on. That would be a mistake.
I want to get into some of the research projects you just mentioned, starting in Flagstaff, Arizona. Now, here's a staff member at a hospital in Flagstaff talking about some of the infections that they're seeing.
We're seeing a lot more patients that were previously normally healthy have to be admitted because they've gone through multiple outpatient courses of antibiotics. They haven't improved. And at the point that they come in, that bacteria has gone into their bloodstream. And that requires immediate hospitalization. You don't have a normally healthy 30-year-old woman come in who's never been in a hospital with a resistant urinary tract infection that's moved to her blood Where did she get that organism from?
And that's the question researchers there are asking. What are those researchers in Arizona looking for?
Well, they're, first of all, taking the isolates of those infections from 1,200 people over a year's time, and then equal number of samples from supermarket meat counters, supermarkets all around Flagstaff over a year's time. Then they're subjecting both of them to whole genome sequencing, which is a very sophisticated way of looking at the entire genetic makeup of the bacteria. And they're looking for matches, because a match would tell you if the same bacteria was on the chicken that had infected a person, and it might suggest at least a source for those infections that Elizabeth Dupree's was just talking about in the sound that you played.
So this is research that will take years. What have they found so far?
So I think they're a little more than halfway through it, and they've begun to find matches. Now, out of 1,200, I think Dr. Price said they've found about 100, and a quarter of those are resistant. So I think the research, I wouldn't want to draw conclusions before it's finished, because it needs to be finished and peer-reviewed and published. But he let us get kind of a sneak peek at it, and it does suggest that there are matches out there. And that's, you know, that's useful information to understand why so many women were coming to the hospital with these resistant urinary tract infections.
And now this is a mode of transmission where the resistant strains would be in the livestock, and we'd get it through contact with meat, and then either it's uncooked or it contaminates lettuce that it touches or something like that. You looked at another possible mode of transition in central Pennsylvania, these MRSA, the resistant staph infection, is it? What did researchers look there in Pennsylvania?
So there, the researchers were looking at this particular resistant infection that they think, were worried was spreading to a greater degree among people who live close to big confined feeding operations for swine. And they meticulously went door to door, basically. They plotted the address of every MRSA infection in this part of central Pennsylvania over a period of time, because they had this great database from a hospital system there, a healthcare system that kept track of that data. Then they took all those addresses and overlaid it with all the addresses and the known locations of the swine farms, and they checked out where all the manure from the swine farms was being spread on the crop fields. And by correlating this in a study that was epidemiology, this was not biology, it was epidemiology, looking at relationships of data, they found that the people that lived closer to these swine farms were 38% more likely to get one of these resistant infections. It's generally a skin or a soft tissue infection, MRSA, but it can be very, very difficult. And one of the things that I thought was interesting was, again, this was not a conclusive research, but it kind of pulled the curtain aside and showed you a pattern that you might not have thought about otherwise.
And how do the researchers think that the disease got from this manure spread in the fields to people who live near these operations?
Well, one of them says, you know, first of all, 600 million gallons of manure is spread on the central Pennsylvania fields every year for fertilizer. But just imagine a couple of weeks without rain. It gets dry. A wind kicks up. It blows it. There's a lot of rain, right? The runoff through the streams. The manure carries residual antibiotics and resistant bacteria, antibiotic-resistant bacteria that have been passed by the swine. So it, too, could be contributing to this problem of resistance for human health by putting it into the environment. And that affects all of us. A wind blows by, a dust storm, the water flows off onto your lawn. Your kid goes and plays on a playground, gets a cut on the knee.
Now, how does the livestock industry respond to scientific work like this and to calls for more regulation of antibiotics in livestock?
Well, for a long time, the industry said, we're using antibiotics that are really old school and they're not important for human health. And that's true. The antibiotics they're using were not critical to human health. But we interviewed some researchers that conducted an experiment using those older antibiotics, and they were surprised at what they found, because they found that they could generate resistance to newer, more modern antibiotics as well. And that's another interesting moment where we don't have some conclusive proof, but we have a glimpse, perhaps, of the forces that are driving this increase in resistant bacteria that affects human health.
And what kind of regulations have you been seeing people call for? Are we talking about completely eliminating antibiotic use on livestock, or just limiting the ways we continue to use them?
No, we should not eliminate, because antibiotics are needed in farm animals for sick animals. And I think everybody agrees that they have a useful purpose, and we have an obligation to use them for animals that are sick. The real question is, there are two uses. One is for promoting growth, because one of the things that we learned after World War II, when American agriculture changed so much, was that you could give low doses of antibiotics to healthy farm animals, and they would grow larger and on less feed. And that was a benefit to the farmers. So that growth promotion was the reason antibiotics were used for decades. Recently, last year, the Food and Drug Administration, for the first time, took an action, the first time really since 1977. And they, perhaps keeping in mind what had happened to Dr. Kennedy in 1977 when he was blocked, they went to the companies that manufacture these drugs and said, would you please voluntarily, over 3 years, phase out the use of these drugs for growth promotion? And we're going to allow you to continue to sell them with a label that says, for the prevention of disease. The companies all agreed to change the label. The FDA also said, we will now require veterinarian supervision of the feed directives, where the antibiotics are added to the feed. And that was a new element, which, by the way, Dr. Kennedy proposed 38 years ago and was not implemented. So it gives you a sense about how hard it is to change this. And I think these two FDA measures are interesting to see if they change the behavior of farmers and ranchers. Will they use less antibiotics if the label says they could only be used for disease prevention? Now, I want to add something about this disease prevention. Most of what we're talking about here is giving low doses to large numbers of animals on the farm that are healthy. Should we be giving antibiotics to healthy animals for disease prevention? There's going to be a big debate about that, I think, and we'll only see in a year or so whether or not it makes a difference. But if you're the bacteria, you know, from a biological point of view, the real issue is we're pouring these into the agricultural environment. Is it creating resistant bacteria that can come back and hurt us as human beings? That's the big question.
We'll leave it there for now. David, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
We've been speaking with Frontline correspondent David Hoffman. His documentary, The Trouble with Antibiotics, airs tonight at 9 on your local public television station. Former Republican vice presidential candidate Paul Ryan is pushing away questions about whether he'll run for the White House in 2016. He says for now he's focused on trying to get reelected to the House of Representatives in Wisconsin's 1st congressional district. Democrat Rob Zerban is trying again to defeat Ryan, and this time at least sharing a stage with a 16-year incumbent. Chuck Kornbach reports.
Paul Ryan and Rob Zerban squared off 2 years ago in the 1st District Congressional Contest, only Ryan was pretty much the House candidate who wasn't there. He was also Mitt Romney's running mate, and Vice President Joe Biden debated Ryan.
That's how it's going all around America.
You don't read the statistics. That's not how it's going.
While Ryan was focused on trying to become vice president, Rob Zerban got within 11 percentage points of Ryan in the 2012 1st District race. This fall, Ryan and Zerban are facing off against each other.
Tonight's debate will feature the incumbent, U.S. Representative Paul Ryan, a Republican from Janesville, and Rob Zerban, the Democratic challenger from Kenosha.
Last night at Carthage College, Zerban and Ryan held their first of two scheduled debates this month, with Zerban arguing the incumbent is now more familiar with the political ways and waters of Washington than of southeastern Wisconsin.
I would say he's gotten so good at the Potomac two-step that I think he may have forgotten where the Root River and the Pike Creek are.
Serban criticized Ryan several more times, saying that as one of the leaders of the Republican majority in the House, Ryan has not been interested in helping President Barack Obama.
And if we have nothing but constant dysfunction, gridlock in D.C. because of the parties not being able to get along, that is the wrong image that we need to send around to the world.
Serban says Ryan has not shown leadership on major issues. Ryan argues just the opposite, noting his bipartisan work on the topic of the budget sequester.
I negotiated the first budget agreement in a divided Congress since 1986 with Patty Murray to get some deficit reduction to save things from the sequester like defense, National Institute of Health, and to prevent two government shutdowns.
Ryan also says he's been a leader in trying to address what he believes are long-term financial problems with major programs, including Social Security.
I would means test it more, meaning not as much of a benefit increase for those who are higher income. I would raise the minimum benefit to make sure that everybody's out of poverty. And I would adjust it in future years for age.
Serban disagrees with some of Ryan's proposed solutions. The two men also differ over the Affordable Care Act. Serban supports, Ryan doesn't, and raising the national minimum wage. Serban wants a boost, Ryan says no. Carthage College political scientist Jerry Mast says the two candidates spelled out their differences. But Mast says Serban's biggest challenge in the campaign is away from the debating table.
Congressman Ryan has raised $8.5 million. That's $8 million more than Mr. Serban. He's an incumbent. Part of the dysfunction of Congress is that 90% of us disapprove of the job of Congress, but we're going to send 90% of the incumbents back.
If Paul Ryan does hold off Rob Serban in the final weeks of the congressional contest, the questions will increase as to whether Ryan will run for president in 2016. Last night, we asked Ryan if this is his last House race.
Oh, I don't think so. I have no idea. I mean, this guy take one term at a time. I'm not one of these people who has my life mapped out, you know, 2, 4, 6, 8 years.
Then Ryan said he thinks there's still a lot more he can do for the people in Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District. Challenger Rob Serban says if Ryan wins next month, Serban wouldn't be surprised if Ryan launches a presidential campaign early next year. Chuck Quernbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now we're focusing on how healthcare workers in Wisconsin are preparing for Ebola. A nurse who treated the Ebola patient in Dallas has contracted the virus, drawing national attention to the precautions healthcare workers are taking.
Gina Denick-Champion is with us now to explain what preparations are being made here in Wisconsin. She is a registered nurse and the executive director of the Wisconsin Nurses Association. Gina, welcome to Central Time.
Why, thank you. Thank you.
I want to start out with some of the basics. What sort of protocols are already in place in Wisconsin hospitals for infectious diseases? And then how does Ebola change those?
Well, the guidelines for any person that where they're really concerned about body fluids that can really contaminate or cause an additional infection, such as tuberculosis or one of those are a major, say, penicillin-resistant sort of bug. What you find are the staff, before they go in to see the patient in their room, you will see them putting on what's called their personal protective equipment, or PPE. And what that, you know, depends on the situation, but what, for sure, you always want it gown up, and you want it to be the type of equipment that where any sort of droplets or water or anything that it's, you know, it can't get through and touch any part of your clothing. They're asking folks, you know, you need to put on a mask, or in some cases they're putting on a respirator. You want to protect your eyes or your face, so there's the goggles or a face shield. What we're hearing in terms of with gloves is you really want to make sure your gloves are covering the actual gown that you have on. In some cases, I was just listening to a conference call put on by the Center for Disease Control, and in one of the hospitals in Nebraska where they're treating two individuals, they're actually wearing three gloves. Two that they talked about are duct taped you know, to the gown. And the third one is used so you can put it on, wash your hands, and take it off. So you're, a lot of folks are actually having three barriers. And that's what's different about with the Ebola, is the amount of coverage that we're finding. Because it's, if you have a nick in your skin and you come in contact with any of the fluids from the patient with the Ebola, you're at risk for developing.
Okay, we're talking with Gina Denick-Champion, the head of the Wisconsin Nurses Association right now. We'll be continuing the conversation in a moment about how healthcare workers across the state of Wisconsin are preparing for Ebola.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think hospitals and healthcare centers are doing enough to prepare for Ebola? And if you work in healthcare, what's going on? What's the message you're hearing at your place of work? Call 800-642-1234 or post to the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We're picking up our discussion on how Wisconsin healthcare workers are preparing for Ebola with Gina Denick-Champion. She is a registered nurse and the executive director of the Wisconsin Nurses Association.
And you can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about what hospitals and healthcare providers are doing to prepare for Ebola? Do you think they're doing enough? And if you work in healthcare, does your workplace, your hospital or clinic, have a protocol in place to deal with Ebola? Or would you like to be hearing more from them? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Gina, before the break, we were talking about some of the protocols already in place in terms of healthcare workers using safety equipment, safety clothing, and that sort of thing to deal with these sorts of infectious diseases. Now, there's been a nurse, as we all know, who's been infected with Ebola in Dallas. And in light of that, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have now said that we need to rethink the way that we handle these potential and confirmed Ebola cases. Are there new guidelines that are actually coming out, or is this just all talk right now? And do you think that we need more guidelines?
Well, I know I was listening to CDC as well, trying to figure out, do we need to rethink, especially in light of this nurse getting infected. When we think about that particular nurse or any of those nurses that are caring for those patients, they may be spending as much as 4 hours in that room caring for that patient, trying to get all those tasks done. And so was the protective equipment that that she was using, did that work for her? And when did the protocol fall apart or the process? And I know that when you're looking, when we have individuals going out now to, even like our military right now, are going over to Africa and those other countries where the outbreak is pretty severe. And those military folks or those nurses that are wearing a full sort of protective gear where it's, you know, it's seamless, you're putting it on, then you're putting it on, it consists of a hood as well as, a bigger mask that you can kind of hold down and tie down. I think that might be one of those sorts of equipment that CDC is looking at. I think they'll also be looking at what's currently in place in some of these organizations where they're caring for these patients to see what seems to work best. There's been other healthcare providers in and out of that room, but it was this nurse that has contracted the virus.
And, you know, we've been focusing a lot on sort of the equipment aspect of all this, but there is a people aspect of it, too. You know, physicians, nurses, other healthcare workers communicating, working together and that sort of thing. Are there improvements there that need to happen when you're dealing with something like Ebola?
Well, I heard two best case scenarios in terms of some of the hospitals, the one in Atlanta, Emory, which is very much, I want to say, connected with the CDC, and how their team worked and how they organized their units so that where that patient is and the laboratory equipment and all of those sorts of things and where the team meets is pretty contained. so that they're minimizing the spread of the infection. And that's part of when you look at what the guidelines that the Center for Disease Control has sent out to all of our hospitals, reinforced by our state health department, providing those guidelines to the hospitals, as well as kind of asking that the nurses that will probably be most involved, really start, they might want to think about conducting drills and how you identify and how you can isolate as soon as possible while that patient is even being, the pre-diagnosis, so to speak.
We're talking with Gina Denick-Champion about the Ebola in Wisconsin and how healthcare workers are preparing for that remote possibility. We've got room for phone calls if people would like to join in. 800-642-1234. If you've got a question about healthcare workers in Wisconsin, how they should be prepared, are they being prepared? What sorts of questions do you have? We go now to Teresa, who joins us from Chippewa Falls. Hi, Teresa.
Hi, it's Teresa. I have a question. Wisconsin Department of Health, a little background. I'm a first responder on a volunteer fire department. We were talking about this at our meeting going, well, what do we do? And we were wondering if dispatch information says we have a person with a fever and vomiting and diarrhea, do we stand down and call hazmat right away because they're the ones who have the suits that are needed to interact with this patient, or do we go in and hope for the best?
That's a great question. Thanks so much for the call. What about that? There are a lot of healthcare workers out there in EMT situations and that sort of thing who are answering some calls on the fly and having to make some decisions.
You're so right, Patricia, that audio and website webinar I was listening to today, they spent a lot of time focusing on the ambulance, but that's when they knew that they were bringing a patient or transporting a patient with Ebola. I think for you, it's very important that, number one, you're identifying that they have these sorts of symptoms, and secondly, the most important is, have you traveled in any of these sorts of countries lately, or do you think you might have come in contact with someone that did? From there, I think what you need to do is you go back to your agency or your fire department, and I would ask them to help develop some protocol for you. I think just so that you are protected, so to speak, and when you're bringing the patient into the emergency room, that the staff are going to be protected. So I would ask that question and say, what if? So you can do that sort of, you kind of know the scenario and what they would want you to do to minimize exposure.
And, in terms of media exposure, everybody has been hearing about this. But in terms of the world that you live in, communicating with healthcare professionals around the state, what sort of conversations are taking place already here in Wisconsin? And how well informed do you think healthcare workers, physicians, and others are about some of the challenges of dealing with this?
Well, I think most healthcare providers have heard about Ebola for quite some time and what's happening in our third world country, so to speak. And the fact that now, because we are such a global society, such a global world, that now we are, Ebola is now coming in. And what we need to do is kind of get to the root cause of it and fix it. So I would say most of our healthcare professionals know about it. I think in terms of now that it's on our soil, I think as healthcare workers, we are all very interested in what this is. I mean, we've heard about it as hemorrhagic fever, as another example of what this disease is. And certainly your organizations that you belong to, as well as your employers, are taking it seriously, and that you can go to the CDC website or go to your own, like the WNA website or ANA website, and you're going to find, what should I be thinking about? What is my personal checklist in terms of what do I need to know? So a person's entering or has these symptoms, The other big question that they're saying you need to ask is, you know, have you been anywhere or have you been in contact with? So that's the antenna, and then it's immediately you get that patient isolated and you get on your, put on your gear.
You know, as I listen, are you optimistic that healthcare workers in Wisconsin have those resources and the information necessary to prevent the spread of Ebola? There are still some questions, obviously, that are being raised about this, but how confident are you that we've got the tools, the knowledge, and the wherewithal to put these steps in place?
I don't think we're there yet. I think we're still in this big, massive learning curve. The CDC is holding a conference call for hospitals, specifically for hospitals, I want to say, this Friday. So it kind of helped clarify some of those concerns or, you know, or the questions, or this is the latest in what CDC thinks should be some best practices. I'm sure that our emergency room teams are learning about it because that may be the place where patients enter, as well as our primary care settings. Again, that's where you may find the individual coming in and with those kinds of symptoms. So I think what we're finding is they're going to prioritize the first in the first, you know, where the person will probably come in. And from that, we'll be able to get that information out further. So far, they've been utilizing critical care nurses, infectious disease physicians, physicians that are critical care. They've had to use some nephrologists, those kinds, but they've been using nurses mostly that have come from the critical care unit because those are the ones that can really, that have the experience of treating multiple symptoms and pretty sick patients all, you know, at one time.
Sure. We've got time for a quick call from Deborah, who joins us from Nina. Hi, Deborah.
Hello. I'm an RN, have retired after 41 years in the profession, and my concern is for this 26-year-old nurse confirmed with the Ebola disease after caring for her patient. When the CDC claimed that she did not follow protocol, in my experience, not following protocol in my or policy in my hospital resulted in liability placed on the practitioner, and resulted in the hospital not being allowed or not allowing the nurse to claim workman's compensation for her illness. This outrages me that they would leave her hanging out there, and I wondered how the executive of our nurse organization feels about that.
Well, let's ask her. That raises one of many questions that could result from this.
Well, Deborah, in terms of what they talk, what they called it was a breach in protocol. That is lingo for that is used in cultures of patient safety. So it wasn't, and it wasn't as they were trying to look at. It's not blame anymore. It's about what happened in our systems. And what broke down? And was it her fault? We're not into blaming, putting any sort of fault on this individual. She was in that room for quite a few hours, and I'm sure she's getting her health care needs taken care of. I don't think there will be a workers' comp issue with this. It's more of the way we're using terms, and I know a lot of nurses seem to think that they kind of threw her under the bus. They did not. It's just the different sorts of terminology that is used these days as they're stepping back and trying to look at what happened, where did, you know, was the process, was there something even before she went into the room that might have exposed her? Was there something in the room that, you know, that might have exposed her? Was it something as she finished, you know, getting out of her gown? Was there, you know, the potential for exposure? So that I really want to share that because they weren't finger pointing, but it was more about, I mean, I'm sure everybody's just, we're all devastated about what happened to her. And, you know, it's who knows what happened. But they need to figure that out for the purposes of improving the processes so the next nurse that goes in is safe.
And that's a good place to leave it. Gina, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Gina Denick-Champion, registered nurse and executive director of the Wisconsin Nurses Association. She was with us to talk about how healthcare workers in Wisconsin are preparing for Ebola.
In its on-again, off-again legal journey over the past 3 years, Wisconsin's voter ID law has been enacted, blocked, provisionally reinstated, upheld, and blocked again.
That's right. After it was first passed by state Republican legislators in 2011, the voter ID law was blocked last April by a federal district judge in Milwaukee who said that it would disenfranchise hundreds of thousands of voters. But then last month, a three-judge panel of the 7th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago provisionally reinstated the law and last week upheld it, only to see it blocked again by the U.S. Supreme Court on Thursday.
After that Supreme Court action, Wisconsin Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen said he would try to put it back in place still for the November 4th elections.
And so there is no doubt that this law has been controversial. We'd like to hear from you in this. What's your take on Wisconsin's voter ID law? Are you for it or are you against it? Call us 800-642-1234 or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Go right to a caller. We've got Ike on the line in Hartford. Ike, hi.
Hello there. Thank you for taking my call.
What do you think of this?
Well, let me explain very shortly. I am what you would call a legal alien. I'm a German living in the States for 17 years now, so 17 years only. And I simply, I cannot understand, it's incomprehensible to me that a country like the United States, with all its possibilities and abilities, is not able to straighten out the laws. Everybody who claims he is disenfranchised because he can't get an ID, I bet if I give them a $50 check, they go to the bank and have ID to cash that check. It's incomprehensible to me. Democracy relies on the people of that country going to vote. And with my German background, it is beyond comprehension. So please, then somebody should change the laws if it gives the different courts so many possibilities to waver up and down.
Gotcha.
But having somebody vote without ID, no, sir, that's not democracy.
Ike, thanks for the call.
All right, we've got lots of other callers who would like to join in. Right now we go to Waukesha, and Bob is with us. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I've actually lived in several other states. I've lived in Florida and also in Pennsylvania. In both of those states, you need to register to vote and you need to show ID before you vote. It is unbelievable to me that a state as progressive as Wisconsin doesn't have the opportunity for people to show an ID when they vote. It seems kind of ridiculous that this law is being challenged.
So in the other places that you've lived, Bob, has there been any controversy about this, or is it just the way it's always been?
No, that's the way it's always been.
All right. One voice heard from. Thanks, Bob.
Thanks for that call. Going out to Jake with us in Madison. Jake, hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. The way I look at it is if one voter, one old lady or whatever, is denied to vote, dude, it's wrong. The whole law is fundamentally wrong. Okay, we have the right to vote in Wisconsin, and even if 12 people try to fraudulently vote, I don't care. It's fundamentally wrong if that one person is denied. Thank you.
Jake, thanks a lot for your call. We are getting your opinions, your takes on voter ID here in Wisconsin, currently blocked for the November election, as things stand, probably on the table for future elections, though. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234 or post over at the Central Time Facebook page.
Yep, lots and lots of opinions on this. And next we go to Decorah, Iowa, and Matt's with us. Hi.
Hi. I believe that it's important that you should be able to vote, but it's also important to have an ID to be able to do that. You have to have an ID to get a checking account, to get a job, to open up different accounts, different places. If you are willing to get a job or take the responsibility to vote, it's easy to go get an ID. Thank you very much.
Matt, thanks for that point of view. We appreciate hearing from you.
I'll go now to John in Racine. John, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, there are estimated 300,000 people in Wisconsin who do not have an ID for a variety of reasons. And they should not be disenfranchised from their constitutional right to vote. It's different than getting a checking account. This is a constitutional right. I urge everyone to look at Salon Magazine recently or read the recent justice's decision that has overturned this, because there are good reasons why things that make it difficult for some people to get an ID, and they should not be disallowed their constitutional right because of that.
John, thanks for the call as we ask for your opinions on voter ID here in Wisconsin at 800-642-1234.
And boy, are we getting them. Myron is with us now from Milwaukee. Hi, Myron.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm great. What do you got?
Well, I used to be for voter ID until I realized how many people it disenfranchised, mainly a lot of the older population, for whatever reason, the cause of where they were born and how old they are, and did they even have birth certificates back then in order to obtain legal identification. And I looked at it, I'm like, wow, well, I'm being a little bit selfish thinking everybody could just go out and get a ID to vote and all these things, because I'm just looking at myself. I can do it, but what about the millions who can't do it? So looking at that, if we disenfranchise one person, then the whole law is wrong. And plus, in the state of Wisconsin, we've been voting for years without this. It's like, this is strictly political. They're using this right here just to get as many votes as they can, because everybody has gotten so extreme lately.
Myron, thanks a lot for the call. Interesting to hear how opinions can change in people.
We'll go now to Marty with us in Elmira. Marty, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. It's my understanding that the percentage of voter fraud in Wisconsin is 0.0034. That amounts to approximately 219 instances of possible voter fraud. Of that, a little more than 100 were people going to the wrong polling place. Now, when something is 0.0034 at fault, does that require any attention?
Marty, thanks a lot for the call. I think we have time for one or two more.
Okay, let's go to Mary now, who is with us from Madison. Hi, Mary.
Hi. My mother-in-law, okay, she's 96 years old. She has a Wisconsin ID. She never drove a car a day in her life, but she's always had a Wisconsin ID. The reasoning being is if she was in a car accident riding the bus, and the bus is in an accident, she's hurt, she wanted somebody to know who she was, where she lived. From that point, they could find out a relative or something. It was for safety.
All right. Myron, or Mary, thanks for that call. And thanks to everybody who called. A real range of opinions on this. You can keep the conversation going on the Central Time Facebook page.